Chapter 22. We passed a night of misery in the brewing hurricane. Without an anchor, we were at the mercy of the wind, and it blew viciously. Many times we just missed tipping over again by maneuvering our weight to shift the boat's center of gravity when the mountainous waves knocked us off balance. High combers kept breaking into the boat, half-filling it every time. We scooped the water out with our twisted garments, although we thought we would freeze, naked in the cold, slashing rain. Toward morning, the gale slackened, but the sea still boiled. As dawn approached and I was able to see a few feet around, I marveled that we were still afloat among those giant, wind-whipped swells. When full daylight came, I saw that our world had closed around us. We were in the center of a small circle of agitated green water, under a dome of gray mist. We could not see far in any direction. Everywhere we looked, the sea was in frenzied motion, countless white-topped peaks appearing, rolling and bursting in a gush of foam. When we stopped shipping water, we sat in the boat with our backs hunched against the rain and wind. We were still drifting to the northeast, making fast time away from where we wished to go. We said very little to each other. We were hungry and disheartened. Toward the middle of the morning, we took the jacket, on which I had drawn our chart, and held it over our three heads to give a little protection from the chilling rain. "Hold it careful, boys," I said. "If we lose this, we don't know where we are." The canvas chart kept the rain off us a little bit, but our clothes were clammy and soaked and plastered to our skin. I would have been glad to see the sun again and wondered if I ever would. "There's your albatross," Tony said. I looked up and saw the old gray bird sailing along above us, his wings spread wide, apparently oblivious to the rain and wind. I watched him for a while until my eyes began to hurt. I lowered my head, relaxing, and my beard scraped the sunburned triangle below my throat. Something thumped me on the head. I sat still and felt a heavy weight settling on the top of my skull. It moved slightly, and after a tense moment I realized what had happened. The albatross had alighted on my head. He was pluming his bedraggled feathers there. I sat very still, figuring what to do. The boys hadn't seen him yet. I considered whether to make a grab for him myself or let one of the others try. The charts being over my head rather complicated matters. There was a chance that as I grabbed for the albatross, my hand would become entangled in the canvas. I studied the situation carefully and decided to chance it. Silently, I slid my right hand outward, gauged my aim as best I could since I was unable to see my quarry, and snatched quickly. The albatross must have been squatting down as I reached for him, because my hand struck him in the breast. The blow knocked him backward into the water. He floundered for an instant, righted himself indignantly, and rose above the water with a flap of his mighty wings. He flew away, high, then circled back as if to reconnoiter us. "Geez, you almost got him, though," Tony said. I was feeling very glum and bitter at my failure in this heaven-sent opportunity to obtain food that we all needed so badly. I was sorry I had not let one of the boys try to grab the bird. They could have seen him, whereas I could not. "Well, I'm afraid he's gone," I said disconsolately. "Cheer up, Chief, it was a good try," Tony said. "Wonder if we can't find a little more room in here," Gene asked. "Any change would help," Tony said. "I'm getting pretty stiff." I myself was sore all over. We shifted our positions so the two of us sat with our backs against the forward thwart, while the third huddled among our knees. "We'd be better off in a telephone booth," Tony said. "It'd be dry." Gene and I mustered a feeble laugh at Tony's witticism. Then we sat silent a few moments as the rain beat on the chart we held over our heads, and the water ran down our necks in cold rivulets. Tony spoke again. "That damned albatross is getting familiar again," he said. "Look to starboard, Chief." I turned quietly, and there was our friend sitting right alongside me in the water. He was feeding. "Oh God, one more chance," I said softly, not in supplication but in gratitude. The huge bird drifted to within 3 feet of the boat and ducked his head under the water. He held his beak and eyes submerged for all of 10 seconds. It was as if he were inviting me to grab him. I thought, if he keeps his head down that long, I'll wait until he does it again and give myself more time. I sat still until he came up for air. He looked about him in the water but didn't move his body. He seemed to find what he wanted and jabbed his bill back into the water. Without waiting longer than it took to gather my muscles for the effort, I dived over the side, my hands outstretched to grab the bird. But I never finished the dive. My feet, instead of driving me forward, pushed the boat behind me. The next thing I knew, I was lying full length, face down. The whole front of me smarted from the smash against the water. In my surprise and disappointment, I couldn't think, but I instinctively dropped my feet and spread my arms to keep myself afloat. My long body was being lifted by the choppy waves, and the boat was already several feet away. As I lunged for the raft, I couldn't help looking for the albatross, who had escaped me for the second time in a way that was humiliating, and worse. The bird was fluttering away, taking his time about it too, and I swear that if birds can laugh, the gray albatross was hooting at me. Tony grabbed me by an arm, and I was quickly in the boat. "Where's the chart?" I demanded immediately. "It went over the side with you, Chief." I turned, but instantly I abandoned whatever idea I might have had of diving to retrieve the chart. In that sea, it was gone. We were now without a single article of any use to us, except our anchor line, one water rag, badly tattered, a pair of pliers, and the pocket knife. We were without protection of any kind against the weather, except the sparse clothing on our backs. I decided to strip off the useless oar pocket to make a covering for our heads. This I did. The piece of fabric thus obtained was almost square, 20 inches long by 16 inches wide. It served us better than nothing. It rained steadily all morning. Shortly after noon, we hit a heavy squall, with high winds and a terrifying sea, and we tipped over again. How we got back into the raft against the waves, I don't know. When we did, we found that all our gear was gone. Knife, pliers, our newly obtained head covering, the unsuccessful sea anchor, and our last rag. Now we had nothing to protect ourselves, nothing for bailing, nothing for catching food. Our courage almost failed. This had been a day of horrible disaster. Tony Pastula, bless his game soul, spoke up at last. "Well, fellas," he said wryly, "it's all happened now, it looks like. What do you say we shake hands all around and start all over again?" Jean and I instantly agreed. Crouching in the wobbling rubber tub with the wind blowing icy rain at us in fire hose gusts, we exchanged handshakes and declared to each other that this would be a new beginning.